What's up, everybody? I go by the name of Doggy Diamonds. You are now listening to No Filter Podcast. No filter means honesty. If you're afraid of honesty, then this ain't the podcast for you. We gonna be honest today.
Yeah, what's up, everybody? It's your boy, Doggy Diamonds. Another episode of No Filter Podcast. I got a special guest on the line right now. Let them know who I'm on the line with.
Yeah, this is DJ Mr. Mix of the world-famous Two Live Crew from Miami, Florida.
Whoa, world-famous Two Live Crew. That means that for some people that don't know, what records did Two Live Crew make that they hear all the time?
Yeah, they hear Hoochie Mama all the time from the Friday soundtrack. Shake a Little Something, Pump, 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 Get It, Get It. That's on, what's that cheerleading movie? Bring It On, Me So Horny's in American Pie, We Want Some Pussies on Project X. Just goes on and on and on.
For most people, the most famous one that I know, that everybody know, is Doodle Brown.
Yeah, that one too. That's a Luke solo record, but you know, Two Live Crew collectively, those other records are what I was mentioning. So yeah.
So that's the last one
out of them, right?
I always thought Doodle Brown was a two, but I can't look at Luke as a soloist without always thinking about everybody else, because I never saw him as a soloist first. I always saw Two Live Crew.
Right. Well, it's really funny how the actual record came about. Basically, we was going through stuff with each other, and Pop That Coochie came out. The video, it was like the number one video on this thing called Video Jukebox, where you would pay to get a visual of the actual video on your cable box. It was like number one for 20 weeks. So it was time to do the second single off of the album, but you know, everybody was living in different places and the logistics wasn't working out and this and that. So I guess Luke figured that he would do, the record I Wanna Rock, which everybody knows is Doodoo Brown. And it got interjected of starting his solo project in the middle of the campaign of the Two Live Crew's last album. So that's why a lot of people, you know, don't look at it just like how you're saying. They don't look at it as a solo situation. They look at it like it was something that, you know, Two Live Crew did, but it was his thing.
So let me ask you something. The inception of Two Live Crew, if I'm not mistaken, he wasn't in the original group, right? Luke?
No, he never was. He was never looked at as a member in that way. He was a concert promoter. And he brought us down to Miami. We were living in California in the military. But those records, those are early singles that hadn't made it nationwide. Like the records ended up going nationwide when we hooked up and me and the other members relocated to Miami. We put both of our, situations together, him doing concerts and having nightclubs in Miami, along with me doing the music and bringing my comedy collection of records down there and mixing it up with the Caribbean dance records that they had in the marketplace. You know, it was like a hybrid of all these different things that made the situation become what it became.
So who was the original members of Two Live Crew?
Myself, DJ Mr. Mix, I produced all of the music. Chinaman, Fresh Kid Ice, and there was another guy named Amazing V. We were all in the Air Force at March Air Force Base in California. And when we came to, we had met Luke on the first singles that we did while we were still in the service. So we had came down and did a couple of shows with him, and we liked the way that we were being treated down there. So the next time we went down there, we seen these guys and girls doing this dance on the dance floor, and it was called the Throw the Dick Dance, Throw the D Dance. So what we ended up doing when we went back to California we made a record based off of what it is that we seen in Miami. And that's what started everything off when the record got finished and, was time to, you know, try to find somebody to put it out. Nobody in Miami wanted to put the record out. So Luke took his own money and pressed up some copies to go to the record pools and different things like that. And the record took off in the market.
So you already had a few records prior to even meeting.
Right.
What were some of the songs right. that y'all had already before you even met him?
Well, there was a song called The Revelation, which was kind of like, that was the record that the other rapper Amazing V did. And then on the flip side of the 12-inch was a record called Two Live that everybody knows as Beatbox that did very well in Miami. That was
this is under the name Two Live Crew.
Two Live Crew. Right, right,
okay.
right. Exactly. Right.
How y'all get that name if it was three of y'all though?
Well, two as in T-O-O. That's what it was supposed to. But the two just looked better in print.
Gotcha. Makes for marketing, it makes all the sense in the world. Because I'm like,
right.
two live crew. Like, and I can understand live meaning that you're lively. So I get
right.
that. So, but then I was confused. I'm like, the two live crew was three of y'all. So y'all meet with Luke from doing shows. When does he officially become a member of the group? And then now you have, after a while, I guess, Brother Marquise is in the group. So, because
right,
when
bro.
I seen, yeah, but not to cut you off, but when I seen Two Live Crew, it was all of y'all. That was my first introduction
right.
to Two Live Crew, me being in Brooklyn, New York. When did Luke become a member of the group?
Well, what happened is that Chinaman and Brother Marquise didn't have good stage presence. They knew how to do their lyrics in the studio and all of that stuff. But when it came to getting on stage and them being able to command the stage in between songs, it was a problem. They didn't know how to communicate with the audience. But Luke also, by being a concert promoter, he was a DJ. So Luke was coming out doing the management on us. He was handling all the business. So he's seeing all of this stuff from the sideline saying, man, I can't let my situation that I done invested my money into die on the spot just because these cats don't know how to perform for real. So he started going out there on the stage and being, you know, saying the little hype things like DJs would do in Miami. And he, you know, was able to command the stage. And then all the guys had to do was just do their lyric parts and didn't have to had the responsibility of holding up the show.
Got you. So that made him, that's when he just said, I might as well just join the group.
Well, I mean, he just felt like he was just doing what he felt he needed to do to protect his investment. It wasn't like so much that he was wanting to be a part of the group in that way. He just wanted to handle the business. I basically asked him, you know, as the leader of the group, to manage us, because I was super green about, you know, the business part and this and that, and the way that he flew us down there. You know, when we did the first couple of shows with him, we didn't even have no contract. We didn't even know to ask for a contract or where we're staying, what kind of spot we staying in, nothing. And he
wow.
knew that we was just super green based on that. So.
And what year was this?
This was in 85 going into
wow.
86.
So Eric B and Rakim is out. All his great boom bap vintage hip hop is out, and y'all have a sound that's completely different from all of that.
Right, because you know, but the thing was, I was a scholar of the New York stuff, because before I was in the Air Force in California, I was in England from 82 to 84. So
mm-hmm.
guys like Bambaataa, Rocksteady Crew, Fab Five Freddy, all these people would come to London to do exhibitions and different things. So I learned the New York hip hop scenario by them coming over. And I learned
gotcha.
How to, you know, I got my first set of turntables when I was in England and learned how to scratch and all that stuff based on what I've seen Africa Islam do at one of these things, one of these exhibitions that they would come over and do. So I just, you know, before that, you know, all through elementary through high school, I played saxophone. So I was already musically trained. So I just looked at the turntables like an instrument.
Another instrument.
Versus
yeah.
it just,
so,
right.
So you go from, so the natural progression most of the time is to go from DJ to producing. What was like, what was the first musical equipment you was using to make music?
Well, the funny thing about it is that, you know, I'm hearing the records, and at that time I was like 18 in the service. Planet Rocket first came out, and Numbers with Kraftwerk came out. So I would read magazine articles that they were talking about this drum machine, the Roland 808 drum machine. Was used to make Planet Rock. So I felt like, you know, Planet Rock was like the most innovative record I had ever heard in my life, because, you know, before that, all you had was funk bands doing what it was that they were doing, but it didn't sound nothing like what that record sounded like. And also at that time, you know, I was pop locking. I wasn't doing no breaking, but I was pop locking. You know, a lot of people didn't really think that pop locking was out, like, you know, since 78, 77, and all the way up in, you know, when I was over there in, like, in 1982, there were other Americans that was on the military base that were dependent children that was going to the high school over there. So I'm 18, but I still could relate to the guys that was in high school that was in 10th, 11th, 12th grade. So I had some of those young guys, we made a pop locking group, was popping off of Planet Rock and Play at Your Own Risk and all of that. And we had, got into a talent show out there in London, and we won second place, which was like $500 worth of stereo equipment. So I was able to get a drum machine, some microphones, and a couple other little trinkets. And one of the things was a Roland 606 drum machine. So I learned how to program that machine, which in turn was basically the same way as the Roland 808 was programmed. And then I actually finally seen one in the at the music shop. But at that time, it was like $1,400 or something like that. Couldn't get that on no military salary. So,
yeah.
But I did tinker around with it in the store. So I had an understanding of how it operated, because it operated pretty much close to the 606 that I had won in the contest. So when I got back to California in 84, I found a 808 drum machine at a pawn shop for $300.
So you lucked up.
Right, exactly. But at that time in 84, they were trying to really ruin the reputation of the 808 drum machine. They were saying that, you know, the drums don't sound like a proper drum, like the Linn drum machine did. And there was another drum machine called an Oberheim DMX. The sound sounded more like drums. So the 808 was being, you know, kind of, you know, shitted on, basically.
Yeah, trying to say it was obsolete, yeah.
Right, exactly. So they were, you know, they were being sold in pawn shops for little or nothing. And that's how, you know, I came up on it. And like I said, I already knew how to program it. But what I was hearing with Run DMC and a lot of the other early rap groups, like, you know, 84, 85, they were using that drum machine. So I was emulating a lot of the stuff that that I was hearing on the records to get my production skills up. So it got to the point where we you know, put ourselves to the test. Let's go, you know, do a recording at a local recording studio and see if we can make something happen. And that's the single that I was telling you that did well enough on this California label that Luther Campbell heard the record, and they started marketing and playing the record at the club and got the record hot for us to be able to come down there and do a show for them. That was his old get down. He would bring Tila Rock, Divine Sounds, Ultimate 3 MCs, all of the people in the early 80s, he would bring them to Miami, along with Run DMC and LL and them too.
So you doing your early sound? If somebody say Mr. Mix is responsible for the Miami bass sound, how would you react to that?
Well, it would be the truth.
Right, fuck being modest, right? That's the fucking truth.
Well, I don't know if it's so much being modest. I will say this: there were people down there in Florida that were making records, and they had a lot of bass in them, but they were all offshoots of other records that was popular. So it wasn't nobody that had, their neck sticking out being an actual act or artist. There was one record, MC Shy D was making records, in Fort Lauderdale, even though he was out of Atlanta. And, he had a record that was, doing pretty good. He took the, Pink Panther, theme and, made a song out of it called Rap Will Never Die. So that was playing down there. But the thing, what I did is I took the vibe of what them DJs, the different break beats that they would play at the parties, like Dance to the Drummer's Beat and Jam on the Groove and a couple other records that I hadn't heard before. I took the, what it was they would do at the hot part of the party, they would play these particular records. So when we did the Throw the D song, those elements of what was going on at those parties was mixed into that actual record. So the locals was already vibing it off the rip. So it was just being alert, paying attention to what it was that was happening, what was going on. A lot of the, the New York underground scene was okay, but it wasn't overwhelming, in Miami, but just like I said, there was a couple of different records that was made that were offshoots of those songs in the marketplace. But there was, outside of this one girl that was like a freestyle singer named Connie, she had a record called Funky Little Beat. You can kind of lightweight say that, it was more freestyle sound than it was Miami bass. But it could have been kind of viewed like Miami bass a little bit, because you still had Pretty Tony and Freestyle and them down there. They were making, the dance music records that was pretty big all over the nation. When I Hear Music and a couple of other records, his records were pretty big, but they didn't have hardly no bass in them. They were just like, just flat out dance music.
So when you say bass, is that just the 808? That's what makes the bass,
exactly.
Or is it the bass sound?
The deep 808 sound that,
got you.
Even though those records was done with the 808 drum machine. I don't know if you're familiar with the machine, but for the kick drum that's on the machine, there's a whole bunch of different adjustments that you could do to make the kick sound different. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people didn't turn the knob all the way to the right to where it sounded like it's overmodulated, but I did.
Got you. So, you create this. What about the tempo though? The tempo seemed like that shit was like, what was the tempo? That shit seemed fast as hell.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. All of the Caribbean records and different things that they were doing down in that part of the country, if you ever been to Miami, it's more Caribbean than it is American. So a lot of the, the fast paced music, if I think of,
Soca.
Gloria Estefan.
Got you.
So if you
like
put
the
that in your
Latino
mind,
Caribbean type
right,
stuff.
Exactly,
Latin Soca. Okay,
exactly.
Got you. So, all right, you creating this music. Two Live Crew is, I guess, you have Marquise, you have Fresh Kid. Fresh Kid, right, can we talk about him for 1 second? Rest in peace, by the way. Is he really, how did you meet him? Because he looked Asian, but he looked black at the same time. So
yeah,
I was confused.
He's Asian and Caribbean. He's from
gotcha.
His family is from Trinidad.
Holy
he, like
shit.
I said, he was in the service. Me and him worked in the hospital at the Air Force Base that we were stationed at. We stayed in the same barracks. That's how
gotcha.
We met.
And when did you realize he could rap? Or was it like, was it something that you helped him move on with? Like, or was he doing his own thing?
He basically was like experimenting, you know. He had a rhyme book, but he was real bashful as far as rapping in front of people or battling. He wasn't that type of dude. So, but at the same time of us being in the barracks, nobody knew one thing from the next to be able to say, oh, are you whack or this or that or whatever, because it wasn't that kind of atmosphere. So,
gotcha.
you know, you can, you know, but if you probably tried to do that when he was in New York, he probably was got laughed out of the building. But it wasn't that kind of atmosphere, you know what I mean? So
he definitely had the throwback hip hop name too, Fresh Kid Ice. He was
right,
definitely
right, exactly.
Hip hop name, like Fresh Kid Ice.
Right.
I wouldn't expect somebody that was, because I always thought y'all were from Miami. You know, I never knew that
you lived
in Ohio. I never thought you was from California. I always thought you were just straight from Miami based off of the Luke affiliation.
Right, exactly. And that's what there's people in Miami that thought we were from Miami or thought that we went to school there and all of that because we were all young when we first, you know, when things started happening. You know what I mean? So they just thought that we were from the area.
Yeah, Luke is also looked at by some as the leader of the group, but then you're telling me you're the leader of the group. So how did that get misconstrued in the eyes of the people? Like, what put that perception that he was the leader?
Because he was the one who, like I say, there was nobody that would take the Throw the D record, so he took his own money and put the money up to be able to start marketing and promoting the actual record, which in turn started the record company, and he was the one that was running the record company. So basically, it's like two entities coming into one. But what we should have did, you know, like I said, I was super green at business and thinking about the what ifs. The what ifs never were questions that would ever come up. So we were just rolling with it because it was an opportunity to be able to make something happen. I didn't have money to be able to do the stuff. And he was getting the momentum in the marketplace, so I was riding on his coattail basically. And but what it should have been, it should have been like how we initially did the Throw the D record. We had it listed as Two Live Crew and Ghetto Style, which was Ghetto Style DJs was the name of his DJ crew. So it really should have stayed like that. So it was really two entities. But we ended up just going on with Two Live Crew because Luke, like I say, he wasn't trying to be no performer. He was just trying to make moves happen from the standpoint of a promoter, but it morphed into being, you know, more than what he even thought it would probably end up being. And, you know, it was like everything was just kind of being done at the seat of our pants. You know, go ahead.
So when you met him, he's Luke Skywalker.
Right.
And then he joins the group. So when does the Amazing V leave?
Well, he left based on the fact that he had more time left in the service. When I got down there the first couple of times that we was going down there, I was getting out. And Kid Ice only had he was able to get his time reduced to 8 months after I got out. So, the migration happened 8 months after, you know, when he got out, and he got out in May of 86. So that's when we were all the way totally moved to Miami by that time, it was around March, April, we were down there, of 86. And
so when you moved, when you moved down there,
leave. Right.
Oh, he didn't want to leave. Okay, so about the same.
Right.
So he didn't believe in the vision, I guess, right?
I think that he had, you know, he had a good job in the Air Force. He worked civil engineering. He worked as a plumber, and he still had, like I said, 2.5 years left, and he wasn't willing to put that up to chase something. You know, it was a bird in the hand versus two in the bush for him. At that time, you know, so, and then also at the same time, we, like I said, I was really experimentation mode. We was letting all different kind of cats, you know, work with us and work on the records. And he felt like, you know, you going in the studio with these guys and that guy or whatever, blah, blah, blah. I don't know if I really want to even be involved with what it is that y'all looking at trying to take this. It's like y'all just, you know, it's like whatever's whatever. Whatever becomes, you know, popular, whatever becomes famous, y'all are just, you know, y'all don't have no particular structure. But I know that he looks back at it now and, you know, he probably have a whole lot to say about how things went. You know, a lot of people think that, you know, since he was more on a conscious tip, like how Melly Mel was making the message and Survival, you know, but a lot of rappers was doing that back at that time. So They thought that that was the way. But then when, like I say, when I took the elements of what was going on in Miami in the street with these girls, the way that they was dancing, they've been doing that down there forever. So none of the girls were coerced or any of that. That was just they vibe. So
you found the booty music, basically.
Right. Exactly. I basically made the blueprint on, you know, Throw the D is pretty much the blueprint of what everybody else started following from that point.
Gotcha. So Two Live Crew is a group. Brother Marquise comes into the group after a while. Did y'all sign to Loop Records as a group or Skyward?
Well, that's the other thing. We weren't even contractually obligated to each other for like 3 years. But we was handling business like we were.
So it was just a handshake homeboy thing.
Well, I don't even know if we shook hands.
Damn. So, all right. So there's no contracts. There's no shaking hands. How do you get your money? How do you get paid? How do you get what you deserve?
Well, that was the whole thing. Us coming out of the service, we don't really know what's what. We don't really know what's being done to what degree, you know. Like I say, Luke was the one that was pressing up the records. He knew the unit cost. He knew what it cost to get a record mastered. The only thing that we kind of knew was what we were spending as far as studio costs were concerned, because we knew how long we was in there doing the records. But getting the records pressed up, what it was that he was selling them for, how many free goods he was giving to the distributor, what kind of terms he had on, we didn't know none of that. We could have, but we didn't. We chose not to do it because, you know, like, and then I'm going to go a step further with it. He actually, when we first started off, he offered us shares in the company, like 10% for each of us. But I turned mine down because I really didn't know anything about business. I didn't know nothing about being liable. I just knew that I didn't really want to be stuck with something that I really didn't have an understanding of what we was really getting into. So as long as I made the money off of shows, you know, getting thrown some money if the records actually make anything, because all of this stuff was being said before any kind of real money was showing up outside of shows. We didn't know to what degree it was going to happen with the records and all of that stuff. But he kind of knew because he could tell how much of a profit margin he was making off of the rip. You know what I mean? And how the records were constantly being reordered. So he knew that. So it was like, you know, he took the don't let the right hand know what the left hand is doing approach, because why mess up a good thing? I mean, they ain't tripping. They're just coming out of the service making a little bit of money. The money they running across and the girls and all the other stuff that they doing, the traveling around, is probably the best times they ever had in their life. Him included.
Industry record, industry rule number 4080. So let me ask you something. For a show, what was y'all getting for a show starting out?
Like I said, when we first came down there to do the thing for him, we didn't even negotiate a price. We just came. We just got on the plane, and he put us up in some hotels, and we did a couple of shows, and he gave us like $300 a piece of doing those shows. So it ain't no telling. You know, I know the first time that we came down there, it wasn't packed. You know what I mean? Okay. I know that. And You know, and just like I said, he paid for the flights, he paid for the hotel. It's quite obvious I don't know what he paid for the hotel rooms or anything, but back in them days it wasn't grand theft though, but just, you know, doing two and three rooms and plane flights and all that along with what he gave us. You know, hell, $300 at that time was more than we was getting on our military checks every 2 weeks.
Got you.
So
yeah, he was balling. He was balling in your mind. was it a point where you ever signed a record deal?
Like 3 years down the road, and the only reason why was because the booking agency couldn't believe there wasn't a contract on us.
Wow. But how many albums have you sold at this time? How many records have you made before you actually signed?
We probably went through, okay, we was on the third album. We was on the album with Me So Horny, you know, midway
what?
Through.
Whoa. You signed, holy shit. So you signed, You signed around
because,
the time y'all made Me So Horny?
Right. That was like the third album in. But it
holy
was because,
shit.
And the only reason why we did was because the booking agency needed to see that we were signed. That's the only reason. We just got some papers. I mean, I would imagine that he protected his interest in the contracts, which that ended up showing what actually happened. Because, like I said, we were getting royalties. We were getting all kind of different things happening all the way up to
okay.
that point. We never had to prove to anybody that we were legally signed to anything because we were just
got
doing
you.
The bookings on our own.
Got you. So all right, looking back, it's 2018 right now. Do you feel slighted? Do you feel like you didn't get what you deserved, or is it your fault? Like when you think about accountability, because you said he offered you something and you didn't take it. But looking back, do you feel like, damn, this motherfucker owed me probably like $50 million? Do you think that now, or is it just like...
No, I don't think that now. I don't think that now. At one time when we were breaking up and there was a bunch of different things that was going on, I was thinking a little funny. But
mm-hmm.
based on, you know, how it is that he put the whole thing on his back, I never had to give up a dime for anything. But you're not thinking about the way that you should be thinking. It's like, well, damn, all the money that was yours was money that was used for to pay off the lawsuits and all the other crazy shit that went on and what happened. So, you know, it's a situation to where you can't really trip off of what it is you really don't know. And then at the same time, if you did know, how cooperative would you have been if a person say, oh, well, you know what? I got to, you know, I had to do this and I had to do that because you guys was foot dragging. Y'all didn't really know what to do, so I had to make a move for everybody. So now the tide done hit the road. What are y'all going to do? Maybe the second album don't ever get made if we know exactly what time it is, or the third, or any kind of history. So I kind of look at it like, okay, maybe the best thing that happened were that we were naive.
Got
because
you.
He wouldn't have been able to make the moves that he made, or we would have been trying to sue him way earlier. You know what I mean?
Got
or we would have just stopped doing stuff, period. Or he would have cut us off.
Or oh, yeah,
just
and
went
the rest, yeah, wouldn't have been no
promoting.
History.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it comes to a point where 2 Live Crew is this this big, you know, phenomenal group in your area. Because I ain't gonna lie to you. Me growing up in New York, I was like, man, this shit whack. Cause I'm used to boom
right.
bap. I'm used to lyrics. I'm like, what the fuck is this shit? How did you feel when, some places in hip hop didn't really accept that shit? They was like, man, this shit is corny. How did that make you feel?
Well, it didn't make me feel, no kind of way for one reason and one reason only. By, you know, I was always an outsider of it. I was never an insider. So.
Gotcha.
It's a situation where, you know, what I did, I think the advantage that I had as being a military person and traveling, I learned that different places is on different things. When I was over there in England, you know, they was on the, the stuff that, Culture Club and all that. That was a big deal over there. But then there was another side with all of the reggae shit with the, Lovers Rock and different stuff that wasn't over here in the States. It was a major issue there. And, and they sold lots of records of that type of music. So when I got to California, you know, you had, before NWA, you had, LA Dream Team and Egyptian Lover and all these other people that they would probably consider was whack too, but it was doing good in California. So I already kind of knew that different places just vibe to different things. And the same thing
if
with
regional.
New Orleans.
Yeah, be
right,
be
exactly. Right. So, you know, so, but New York at the time, not to cut you off, but New York at the time was the blueprint of what could get sold and be massed upon the rest of the country. So you guys had, you know, it was just the business of the music business being, you know, the New York being the mecca of, you know, all kinds of music, you know, and by rap being, you know, created there, it was like you guys made all the rules. So
yeah, which has been fucking changed up in 2018. Like there is no rules now, and
right,
a lot of New York people still mad at that shit. I'm not one of them. So all right, by this time I'm still a little kid, but I'm starting to see your videos. Y'all got booty in the videos, and I'm like, oh shit! I never had the Playboy channel. I didn't even have cable, and
right.
But I'm starting to see booty. When did y'all say, hold on, the women, the booty in the videos, we're gonna use that for marketing? When did that come into the play?
This is what I'm saying. When the Throw the D record was made, it was made off of the fact that the girls was dancing wild and crazy at that time, along with the dudes cutting up with them out on the dance floor. So it was something that was already in that Miami atmosphere.
Culture. Okay, yeah.
So it just you know, was able to morph into, you know, when we did our second album on the Move Something album was when we did our first video. And, you know, the cast was already set for how girls do their thing down there. So it was just exposed to the rest of the country that this is what's going on down here.
So was it really... Like, because I'm trying to figure out, like, how did you escape AIDS and shit like that? Because, you know, it's like, we look at it like, yo, it really was girls, like, nasty like that, all over the place, dancing and shit like that. Like, we couldn't, in New York, we was like, what the hell? Like, y'all really got
right.
it that good like that? Like, how the fuck do you, like, I know you probably went crazy going down there. Like, holy shit. Like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah. It was definitely culture shock. Because no other place in the country was like that. And I think then the funniest thing about it, Miami don't think that they really were doing anything really
wrong
out
yeah.
the way.
So different. Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's just been their vibe. And, you know, it's so hot down there. People are already wearing skimpy clothes as it is anyway. So, you know, just their vibe just in general, that's just the way things are.
Got you.
So now y'all on as
nasty as I want to be, y'all doing that, and then here comes y'all getting looked at as, hold up, y'all going a little too far with this nasty shit. Motherfucking lawsuits start coming, and then they want to ban y'all, and then all this other shit starts happening. What was that like? At the point in your life, because like I said, that was the most, I was like X-rated, but it wasn't really X-rated, but it was X-rated. And then people starting to see like, yo, y'all just went too far now and y'all going to get banned and we going to sue y'all and all types of crazy shit. What was that like?
Well, the coldest thing about it is that we never really thought in a million years that any kind of pushback or resistance, at least I didn't think, because I knew where the source was coming from. It was coming from comedy albums. But we never had the opportunity to, or Luke didn't want to express the aspect of what the creative process was of what we were doing he was, you know, he was happy that the controversy was happening because it equaled his natural personality. So, you know, he would be a lightweight, you know, irritant, along with the controversy being an irritant to most people. So it worked hand in hand with his personality. But we could have easily squashed it and said, look, all we're doing is taking, you know, just imagine if Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy, and Dolemite
Red Fox
was a rap group.
Got you.
That's basically what we were doing, because all we were doing was taking the phrasings of those comedy albums and building the rhymes around those phrases. That's what we were doing. So we never really looked at it like, you know, we were being nasty. We just felt like, you know, we were like rap comedians, basically.
Got you. So, I mean, what was the, like, the whole court thing, lawsuit, you had to actually, like, do depositions and stuff like that?
Yeah. It was a trip because we were all young, but we weren't doing anything that we considered, like, we was breaking the law. You know what I mean? So it was, you know, we're defending ourselves, but we're kind of lightweight laughing about it, too. But it was very serious. But, you know, and, you know, it's quite obvious to look at, spend, you know, a good amount of money for a good, you know, lawyer and this and that to be able to, you know, to stand up in court with the stuff. But shit, at that time, man, I was super green about the music business. You can imagine what I thought about the legal system. You can really go to jail for this shit, because we weren't thinking about obscenity laws or any of that kind of stuff. We never thought that it would ever get to the level of that. But what happens is when, you know, when you get into, you know, social consciousness of distributors and people are talking about your stuff and say, man, how the hell y'all sell all these records? You know, well, there's this group out of Miami that's doing all of this stuff and blah, blah, blah. And people start paying more attention. And it just, like I said, it spiraled into an interest that nobody ever thought would become interesting in the way that it did. You know, and it helped, you know, the New York rappers. It helped NWA. It helped everybody.
Yeah. So was it at a point where they were saying if y'all perform this song this way, y'all going to jail on the right off the stage?
Yeah, in certain places, in certain counties, yeah.
Wow. And y'all did it anyway, or y'all was shook? Y'all
well, in one thing, you know, in Broward County, which is the neighboring county of Dade County, is where all of the stuff started from.
Gotcha.
The police dude, Nick Navarro, that was over the deputies, he's the one who filed suit against us and the record company and all of that stuff. So we had to defend it. And when they ruled, they said that this album is declared obscene in this county. And we actually went to that county and did a show. Now, all of the other stuff, Throw the D and Move Something albums, those weren't banned. It was just Nasty as We Wanna Be. If we would have went in there and did a show and didn't do those records, then there wouldn't have been no problem, because we did two shows that night. We did a clean show and we did the explicit show. So, the reason why we supposedly got arrested was because we defied the order of those songs on the Nasty album being obscene in that county. So that's why the arrest was put in place.
So y'all go to court. Obviously the world knows how that ended up. What was the celebration like when y'all was vindicated in court?
Well, and this is the funniest part about it. They let me go because they didn't think that, you know, I had anything to do with anything, because I wasn't a vocalist on any of those records.
Gotcha.
So they didn't even put me into the situation.
Were you still producing the music at that time, though?
Yeah. I produced the records, but they weren't looking at they was looking at the vocals.
Gotcha.
Not the music, which is crazy. You know, that it just, all it basically was is that they, you know, Luke Skywalker Records was an all-black company. We only had two white people that worked in the whole building. That was the guy that had all of the connects with the distributors and an attorney. And that was it. Everything else was a black-ran company. So I think that they were just kind of, you know, hey, and you got to think about it like this. Check this out.
Mm-hmm.
You got a guy that's under 30 years old that's running a multi-million-dollar record company. That was unheard of.
Yeah.
Luke was 29 when all of this happened. 29.
Without no white man in his pocket and telling him what to do and directing all the traffic. Yeah, so they were hating.
Right, exactly.
So I guess they got vindicated. And what was that like? Could y'all not wait to do like the next show and curse up a storm and perform some of these records?
It was just a relief that nobody had to go to jail over something that really could have been a First Amendment situation. And the only reason why that they won was because the recording that they snuck into the club and recorded. The bass was so loud, it was just the recording that the undercovers did was so distorted, the jury couldn't make out what was being said.
Ah, sneaky bastards, I love. So it wasn't the music that they were banning. They was banning the performance of the music publicly. That's what
right.
That's
exactly.
What the laws. Oh, okay. Okay.
Right.
So y'all was allowed to make the record. But you wasn't allowed to sell it and perform it.
Right, exactly.
Got you.
In that county.
Got you. So it wasn't worldwide. It wasn't international. It was just a county?
Yeah, it was in Broward County, and then that's what the big stink was, but it was in federal court though. That's
got you.
I guess that's the reason why it became such a big issue, because it was done from a federal standpoint.
Got you. Then Band from the USA come. How big was that album?
Well, basically what happened is, this is the thing. Band in the USA album basically came out of the controversy. The court case that just speaking about when it was vindicated went into 1990, like the summer going into the fall. And Band in the USA basically came out based on the fact that all of this stuff was happening, and it was an opportunity for Luke to drop a solo album on himself. So he was able to get Bruce Springsteen to grant us to use the do a cover of the record, and MTV jumped on it. MTV actually built their, the award show around the situation with us. So I'm looking at this stuff and, man, we're making history. And, I'm a young dude. I'm happy. I'm proud of what it is that I did, what I'm involved with. But Luke, at the time, I don't really know what he was thinking as a record exec, how much he was putting on the line for himself, his freedom, this, that, and that. So it was a bunch of disconnects in the group. There were different...
Gotcha.
Vibes that was going on from different people's standpoints. He used to be upset about shit. I didn't understand why he was upset about stuff. But we never really talked like we were homeboys, because we really weren't. We were opportunists to all of each other, basically.
Got you.
We were close, but it was opportunity.
Yeah.
Right.
So it comes a point where the group is flying high. Band in the USA, you got a few more albums drop, and then the group breaks up.
Well, the group broke up from my standpoint was, I figured with all of the hype and hoopla with Band in the USA and all of the stuff that had went on, that was the lowest royalty check that we ever got out of all the time that we had been together.
Gotcha.
And on top of that, Luke had got a big deal with Atlantic that saved us from the records. We were basically, it was kind of like a false band. Basically what happened is a lot of the distributors start sending the records back which was hurting, you know, the company's bottom line. But Atlantic stepped in and gave Luke a deal for the distribution rights to put the stuff where it needed to be. So he got a gang of money from the distribution deal, but didn't share it with me, Mark, or Chris. Because at the end of the day, even though Two Live Crew is the reason that all of this stuff happened, it was a distribution deal, so it's a record company come up.
For Luke Records, but not the group.
Right.
Gotcha. Right. And now you're sitting there saying, damn, I could have 10% of this shit.
Well, not even so much from that standpoint, but, you know, it's really what we call tech, or, you know, you being technical. You know the group is the reason, but you can say based on how the deal is, this is a company thing. You guys ain't signed to Atlantic. Well, I didn't sign you guys to Atlantic. They just want the distribution rights, and I have the right to get that money for the distribution rights. He didn't explain it, but that's how it ended up coming across.
So you leave.
Right,
So did you leave with Two Live Crew, or you just let Two Live Crew stay there and you just left?
Right. I didn't have an understanding of what my rights were by leaving. I left just as David Hobbs, Mr. Mix. I didn't leave thinking that I could take Two Live Crew with me. That's how green I was about what was happening. Even though I knew that we had did records before we got down there with him and this and that, I never really thought about trying to take the group. And maybe that's what, you know, from his business mind, he was just being cool about, you know, pulling the wool off of what was really going on. He was keeping his cool about, you know, shit, Hobbs ain't said nothing all this time. Why should I alert him to, well, nigga, I own this shit, and you better bring that black ass back here. You know, he didn't go that route.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, he's just hot, and he's just mad right now. You know, give him some time. He'll be back, blah, blah, blah. He'll find out it ain't easy out there. He'll be back. So he took that route of it. You know, me knowing it now, I didn't know that then. I wasn't even thinking about it or studying it then. I just knew that he had the money. And there was no way that I could really do any particular things. At least I didn't think I knew. I didn't think I could. You know what I mean?
So when the group split, did everybody leave or just you left?
Well, I left initially because I knew that they, you know, they couldn't get the records done without me. They damn sure tried to, though. They got some other producer guys in there to do some records and this and that, and the vibe wasn't right. So 2-3 months later, I ended up coming back. They gave me a couple of extra dollars to come back. And you know, then we went in there and knocked out the Patacucci record along with the whole album. And
so you did the Patacucci beat?
Right.
Holy shit.
That people know, I did them. You know what I'm saying? So.
But that's still, still 808, right? Or you still was using 808?
Well, I mean, basically what happened is the 808 sounds would get put into the SP-1200. So
the greatest drum machine ever. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
I still got mine in the closet. That makes me happy.
Right. So, you know, we were able to transfer the sounds from out of the original 808 into the SP-1200, which wasn't easy.
Hell no.
You know, you have to have the bass processed through the studio board before you actually could put it in the 1200. You couldn't just take the cord to go right out of the 808 right into the 1200 to do it, because it didn't, the bass, everything else would transfer good. All of the other sounds would, but the bass didn't transfer well. You had to process it in the studio and then do an out from the studio into the machine. So
pop that coochie. What BPMs is that?
Like 128, 127, 128.
That's what the. But it's funny because 128 is what the SP 1200 standardly started on. Was 128. When you first cut it on, it started.
No,
at
no. What I think is 120, 120.
Oh it yeah, yeah, 120. 120, right. Yeah, you're right. 120. That's why I'm like, damn. So you just sped it up a little bit more than what? Cause damn, 120. So, all right, jump into, you know, recent, and then we could go back. When French uses his record, you get paid?
No. Basically, what happened is that record, when they use that record that they use is Luke's first solo record. I Wanna Rock. Everybody know it as Doo-Doo Brown, but at the beginning, it's an acapella of him saying, "Don't stop, pop that, whatever," at the beginning of the record. So that's the part that they use. But what they did is some more tech. Basically, they used the sound bite, and then they paid the guy that owns all of the stuff now for the usage of the sound bite.
Oh.
Versus doing a publishing aspect of it. They paid for the sound bite usage.
Got you. So you didn't do Doo-Doo Brown?
Right. I didn't do that. That's when I left the second time.
They sound like it.
Right, exactly. There was a whole bunch of copycats down there that could do what it was that was being done. They just weren't in a position to get no work from us.
But then when
I was gone, then, you know, dude Devastator was able to go over there, and he got I Wanna Rock record, and he did Sick What Your Mama Gave You for JT Money, which is another protege. I mean, that's a guy that, you know, the Poison Clan, I brought that group to the company. They were basically my group, but since I didn't know how to bring a group and make it be my contract with them and this and that, I just brought them straight to the company.
So you brought JT Money over there?
Yeah.
Wow. I remember that. Who that? Yo, I used to love that.
That was way before that. That was like, you know, Who That came out like maybe 10 years after he had been out. Because I brought them over to Luke at the same time that Band in the USA was out. Right. So, you know.
So who was in the Poison Clan?
It was him and another guy named Debonair, which they did when I left from down there. It was kind of like I left them twisting in the wind with the company. So JT Money did the rest of the Poison Clan stuff on his own, and Debonair started doing stuff on his own, which was the Groom Home Team that had the Pick It Up song.
Okay. So you, damn, JT Money. So, because when I think of Luke, and I think that was the beginning of Trick Daddy, that was the beginning of JT Money. Did you ever see a young Rick Ross back then?
Well, nah, at that time, you know, Rick Ross didn't exist in the music world at the time that we was doing stuff at that time. You know, okay. I mean, he was a consumer. He wasn't in the game at all, you know, not that I know of.
Gotcha.
And then, you know, Trick Daddy then showed up like around, you know, 96.
Got you. And by that time, you wasn't in the
right, exactly. I was all the way out of the situation by that time.
So when you leave Two Live Crew, what I'm trying to understand is that how do you leave your group that you founded?
Right.
And then you have to come back to your group.
well, that's the whole thing. Like I say, it's hard to believe that I was that lame or not having the right understanding of what my true positioning was. And I looked at it from the standpoint that this guy had the money. He was doing what it was that he was doing. I didn't know what leg I could stand on. I was getting a whole bunch of bad information from guys that really didn't want to see me do all that well. There was nobody to my defense at all, and I wasn't sharp enough to go ask for what can I do. I didn't involve my father, nothing. I mean, it was just totally, I was just a total lone wolf, a lame lone wolf. That he figured that, you know, at the end of the day, that I would get my mind right and just come on back over. So what kept me away was blind integrity.
Yeah. So you leave the group. What did you do when you left? What was your, were you still in the music business or?
Yeah, I was I was saying, man, I made all those records. I'll find some new rappers and make some new records. And
okay.
I was out there in California for a little while and was working with different little guys and trying to put a project together. But my experience was making the records, mastering the records and all of that. And then it's the record company's position to take it the rest of the way. So I didn't think that far down the road of who was going to distribute the records. And I didn't really think about, you know, do I got a budget to actually put these records out or, you know, because I always felt like, you know, you could get signed by somebody or some distributor will take you on and they'll take the brunt of that action. I didn't really think about that, you know, well, shit, you know, what money are you bringing to the table for us to take a risk on your own? And then on top of that, I didn't even think about the other politics that could happen was to the point where, you know, Luke could have gave the guy the same distributor a call, say, hey, man, you know, I know how I'm just trying to do something out there, man, you know, stall him on what it is that he's doing, you know, I'll give you a better price on the records. You know, you never think about what those type of situations could really be, you know what I'm saying, when you're just trying to prove a point. You're not thinking clearly. And if you ain't got nobody that's in the game that knows the game that can pull your coat, I probably would have stayed, you know, knowing that I probably could have talked better if I had a little more representation. Because, you know, not to take nothing from Luke, he would listen if, you know, if he felt like, you know, but it got to the point where there was no more talking because then he felt like I was ungrateful or the group guys were ungrateful.
So when you gone, you miss the whole Luke's Peep Show thing. You miss H-Town.
Right.
You miss all of that stuff.
Right, exactly. Right.
And as you were a producer, did any other groups outside of Miami, like main major groups, sought after your sound? Did anybody ever hit you up and say, I need you to do some music with me?
Different little dudes would, you know, reach out, you know, but you got to think about, you know, and this is the other thing that I really didn't think about when I went all the way to California. You know, I was married to a girl that was from Oakland. So I went back to Oakland, you know, I was up there with her and her family based out of the fact of being there because by her family being there, I'm, you know, there's security. And I was from Southern California initially. So I didn't have, you know, when I left from down there from Miami, I didn't have no family there. There was no real reason for me to stay put if I wasn't dealing with Luke and them because nobody else was getting money like them. It just wasn't, you know, it didn't make sense for me to stay down there. So, you know, I just did the best thing that I could do for myself. But I had a little stint with Ruthless. I was going to produce J.J. Fadgman's second album. I was talking with Easy on different little things, but like I say, I knew how to make the records. I wasn't a diplomat when it came to trying to make people do what needed to be done. You know, so when I was in the studio with J.J. Fadden, and we went over like maybe two or three records, but I didn't realize that maybe a lot of the stuff was being, you know, they were being guided and being taught how to do this and how to do that. I'm looking at them as that, you know, they should be able to write up some shit and this, that, and the other, and we should be good. But they weren't. Evidently, somebody was writing stuff for them or making it easier for them to record. So that ended up not working out because it just wasn't a good fit for it was a good fit music-wise, sound-wise, but as far as execution of them doing what they needed to do, because Easy would say, man, just tell them bitches to get in there and do this. So, okay, so I'm supposed to be doing that. Shouldn't it be somebody at your record company
that should
be in there helping me get this part of the
A&R
movie done?
This shit? Yeah, A&R this shit or something. Yeah, I just want to do the beats and shit and make them construct the song. I don't want to be tough. You say Easy, you said tell them bitches to get in there? What was Easy E like?
Probably one of the coolest people you ever want to meet, flat out. I'm going to tell you a story. One time I had to go meet up with him me and my wife drove over there to his offices in Canoga, where is it? In Woodland Hills. I never even knew this part of L.A. even existed. Most people, when you go to L.A., you're in Hollywood, you're in Beverly Hills, you feel like that's it. You don't even know about the San Fernando Valley. At least I didn't. Once you go over the mountain, it's a whole other part of L.A. I didn't even know existed. So I thought, wow. God damn, when are we ever going to get to this nigga's office? So we get to Woodland Hills, and I meet him at the office over there. And I see him pull in with his BMW, and there was a white hoopty bucket following him in through the gate. So I figured it's just probably somebody that's following him in to be at the meeting or whatever. So as he starts walking up, there's a girl that gets out of this hoopty car, right? So when we all get close enough to each other to start talking before we get into the building, you know, I introduce my wife to him, and you know, they shake hands, whatever. And he looks at the girl and he said, "What'd you say your name was again?"
Right.
He had just picked the chick up off the street, man.
Yeah.
And had her over there to the office.
Wow.
Easy. When you being in California, you living in California at the time where the whole Death Row versus Luke shit was taking place?
Yeah, the Death Row stuff. Yeah, I was in California at that time. Yeah.
Did you ever want to call Luke and say, "Yo, man, fuck that, I'm down"? Because you know, initially, they felt the way about Luke, but I know you probably had some.
Well, they were in. They were in. At that time, I was in Oakland, you know, and Death Row's in Los Angeles. But I wasn't, you know, and at that time, you know, Easy, you know, at that time, no, I wasn't even. Yeah, I was talking with Easy now, but it wasn't all that heated like how, you know, Dre Day was talking about. It hadn't got to that point yet. I think that was close to, yeah. No, I was down there like 91, 92 instead of like 92, yeah. 93, because that's when all the Death Row stuff started happening. But the funniest thing about it is just like I say, at that time, you know, dudes wasn't really traveling. Nobody really knew how Miami really was. People had an idea of how L.A. was, but they weren't out to L.A. enough to really know about the Blood and Crip stuff to the level of what it was back at that time. The Miami cats didn't. They didn't know nothing about what level it was. And, you know, but me and Marquise, by us being from California, we knew. You know, Marquise was really affiliated with some of the people out there in L.A., so he already knew what time it was going to end up becoming, you know, just the brashness of Miami cats. You know, if you have an understanding of the brashness of Ray Lewis, that's the average Miami dude's attitude. He just do it on the football field. So they weren't stunning what Death Row them was talking about or any of that. So I already knew it was going to be a problem. I knew it was going to be a big issue. You know,
I seen a situation maybe, I think it was a year ago or a year and a half ago when Peter from Real Housewives of Atlanta and Luke were going back and forth about who really was to put Miami on. Whose side did you take in that situation?
Oh, well, I mean, Peter Thomas, he didn't show up to South Beach, and, you know, that was like the, you know, like 93, 94, he had a convention down there on the beach. But in them days, you know, the beach was nothing. Nobody would go on the beach to party or anything. Everything was on the mainland side of Miami. No, there was no black stuff going on the beach at all. You know, nobody would even go over there until Luke got the club over there. People started lightweight venturing over to where Miami Beach was, and Luke's club was right as you come off of the bridge to get over there. So you ain't really deep on the ocean drive or any of that. So when Peter Thomas was coming down there, I guess he figured that, you know, he has some kind of claim to say something because he felt like maybe he was the only one that was over there and was doing a convention. He had the How Can I Be Down convention there. All these New York cats was coming down there to the convention and this and that. So I guess he kind of felt some kind of way like he's the one who brought hip hop down there to South Beach and all of that. When it was, we already had our own thing there. We just wanted to do
it. You were there before him, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's just a situation to where, you know, Peter Thomas really didn't know what he was talking about when it came to that aspect. Maybe he might have made it more cool for New Yorkers to want to come to Miami and kick it. Maybe he could lightweight say that. But
yeah,
the fact of bringing hip hop there, you know, I don't know about that. You know, nah, I would say that is a no.
Yeah. So what was the last show you did as Two Live Crew with all the original members?
There was there's been little stuff here and there, but with all four of us actually being on stage together, there was this one thing that we had to do in Houston. This was like in 91, 92 or something like that. We had got sued by a promoter there because we didn't do a show, based on the fact that it was a show that us and Eric B. and Rakim then was on. And,
that's
we felt like, huh?
That's a weird ass mix.
Yeah, but both of our records was hot at the same time in Houston.
Okay, so it was a great mix. Yeah, it was a great
yeah,
mix.
Yeah, so basically what happened is we were contracted to close out the show. We were the headliner for the show. But Eric B. and Rakim them and their management wasn't trying to hear it. They feel like Eric B. and Rakim them should be closing out the show. So... okay, so they tried to come to us with the fact of that's what they're doing. Said, nah, we're supposed to close out the show. Matter of fact, fuck it, we ain't even going to do the show. We're going to go back to the hotel. So we went back to the hotel. Eric B. and Rakim them do the show and this and the other. We're still over there posted up at the hotel, not tripping. We went back home the next day, so the dude sued us. So we had to end up doing a makeup concert for him 5 years later. So
gotcha. That
was the only time that was the last time that all four of us was actually on stage with each other, which sounds terrible. But and there was an opportunity that could have happened maybe a couple of years ago. For some reason, they didn't want me to be involved in the scenario, what it was that was going on with them. But that was just some more other foolish politics that was happening. It's just like I say, we were never, you know, hardline friends evidently, because, you know, me and Luke had never got in no fight or none of that kind of stuff. He ain't never cussed me out. I ain't never cussed him out. It was kind of like a scenario that, you know, Y'all two know it's bigger than this and y'all shouldn't really go that direction. And we never really did. You know what I mean? That's why I can get on the phone and call him right now. And, you know, if he need me to do something, he'll reach out to me or whatever. He very seldom does, but he knows that he can. But I think that a lot of times what happens when cats get older, you know, people know what their worth is and, you know, if I know that I ain't going to pay you your worth, or if I feel like I got to come at you with some BS or whatever, I'd rather not even call. And that's kind of like how it is.
Unfortunately. So the Hip Hop Honors thing, what about that?
Hip Hop Honors, that was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
That scenario was, just like I say, I basically, you know, there was still, you know, bad blood between, you know, with the bad blood was more so with Luke, with the other two guys, with Mark and Chris. Not so much with me, because I did music tracks with him when he was doing stuff with Pitbull and other different people when he was doing, his own Luke Records thing, like in the early 2000s and stuff. So I would come down and do stuff on and off. but he really wasn't feeling, you know, Mark and Chris. So when it, you know, Hip Hop Honors happened, you know, he wanted to make sure that he was separated from sitting with them and this and that or whatever. He just really wanted to, he just really felt like, you know, as a unit, we were all ungrateful and, you know, you don't feel the wrath of how he feel about the situation. That's basically what it's been up to this point. You know, I just,
What was your relationship with Chris? Because y'all came in together. Like, how come y'all never just went off and formed?
Because
and Chris,
because
when you say
was,
Chris, it's Fresh Kid Ice.
So right, exactly, right, right. Well, the thing is that we weren't all that close either when, you know, it was, like I say, it was an opportunity. It wasn't like so much that we were talking from having each other's back. It was like, you know, how long are we going to be able to keep the ship in the ocean? That's what it, when I look back on it now, you know, because I never would go over to his house and say, hey, man, you know, we got to figure something out and this and that or whatever. We would never have those kind of conversations. There would be some hate conversations, like Mark always felt a particular way about Luke. And, you know, he really didn't like it in Miami. He probably was, you know, the most outspoken guy because he was the last one to come in and he could kind of see all of the players' perspectives. So since he was brought into the group by me, maybe he didn't really feel like he had enough power to really speak on things, but that didn't make him feel like, you know, the situation was any better because of it. He really kind of was probably more upset that the situation was like that. You know, so it's just one of those situations, man, that, you know, maybe two great conversations early on probably would have squashed a lot of shit, but those situations never happened. You know what I mean?
So,
and it's unfortunate.
So who owns the rights to the Two Live Crew name right now?
Well, right now, Joe Weinberger that runs Lil Joe Records, that has, you know, he has the name of the group. He also has all of the old masters of what it is that we did in the past through other stuff that, you know, that was him and Luke's fight, you know, because Joe Weinberger, he was a chief financial officer for Luke for a long time, and they had a major falling out with each other. And it's like on some Hatfield and McCoy shit with them, basically.
So do you still get royalty from all of that?
Well, I get royalties for some stuff, but not all of it, you know. But it's like I say, at that time when all of the stuff was going on, you really didn't know what your rights were. And, you know, one thing that I've learned in this game is that it ain't about what you create. It's what you're able to keep in your control. There's a lot of big bank take little bank that goes on in this business. So, you know, like just recently I heard that Puffy just barely got his masters back from Arista because he didn't have his masters, you know, but he has the success. So it's like, you know, it ain't no telling what it is that he had to pay in order to get them. He got them now, but, you know, I always look at the scenario with the masters, especially now. I look at it as more insignificant, you know, because but the thing that gives masters its specialness is if somebody dies, if somebody can't reproduce what it is that was done, because we live in an age that something could be exactly replicated. It ain't like back in the Motown days where you had to get the tape exactly
right
in order for
the
you know, if there was a that guy, Easy Mo B, that did Flavor in
Your
Craig Mack record.
Yeah, he played it on his Instagram.
Right, exactly.
That's Mo B, that's the homie. So if you wanted to do a Two Live Crew reunion tour, can you not use the name?
Yeah, well, what's happening is I work with the guy, Joe Weinberger now. I work with him based on doing Two Live Crew shows as it stands right now. And hopefully that one day can show up to where, you know, me, Mark, and Luke can work together and do something. But as it stands right now, you know, when people are busy and people ain't really hungry or starving, to feel like that's the last meal that they gonna get is probably not gonna happen. So, which I'm okay with, because we did more than enough stuff as a unit as it is, and the stuff will, you know, it stood the test of time up to this point. You know, it's just, you know, I just hope that everything can become something down the line. You know what I mean? But as it stands right now, it might not. But it's okay, because I know if it's come to shove, if I want to reach out to do it, I know that I can.
Yeah, so, you say that, like, it's okay, but I'm pretty sure the fans would just love to see y'all, with the exception of Fresh Kid Ice, you know, not being here either to make that happen. What's the last conversation you had with him before he passed?
I'm trying to think. Cause I don't think I talked with him for at least 2 years before he passed. It's really ridiculous of how sometimes people handle things. You know, you don't really think nothing of it. I was just telling, my girl the other day that, you know, it'll be a year he's been gone in July, and it just, you know, it just seems like it's surreal, because I didn't get to see him. I didn't get to talk to him. When we found out the information that he might be out of here, it was like 48 hours, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, it's really disheartening from that standpoint. You know, we definitely did do a lot with each other, but I guess we didn't really, we knew each other, but I don't know if we really called each other buddies. You know what I'm saying?
Even after all the touring and the group, because, you know, the average people think, man, they was cool. They came into business together. They came from the Air Force, California. They toured. They got women together. They got money together. And it's strange to hear that y'all wasn't that cool.
Well, it wasn't that cool from the standpoint, like, we had issues with each other. But, you know, like, say, for instance, when we got into the studio or we did the stuff at the shows, everything was all well and cool. But then when we get home, everybody would have their own separate circle of friends.
Gotcha.
Which sounds crazy, but you would think that none of us, we would all just be grouped up together. And that was the other thing that kind of made the group kind of break up, because at the time, when I first came down there, me and Luke was hanging out really tough, but Luke could tell that I was really green about certain aspects of the game. Because really, if I would have been on point, we probably could have been L.A. Reid and Babyface to the 10th power if I really knew how to do stuff. Because there was one time we had went to a convention, and Luke felt like, you know, me and him went to the convention. He was in the convention room, listening to the people talk. I'm out in the lobby chasing women. And up in my room doing what I'm doing, like what I normally have done when I was in the services and this and that. I'm figuring that I'm just here, you know, with him to accompany him on the trip, not necessarily to be in there with him trying to learn the business. You know what I'm saying?
But he never
once harassed me about it, though. He never said, man, I done spent money for you to come up here. Least you could do is be in the goddamn meetings. And, you know, he never did it. He never said nothing.
Got you. There was something wrong with Fresh Kid Ice's arm, too, right?
Oh, yeah. He was in a real bad car accident. One of our other buddies from the service that was down there living with me at the time, you know, him and Chris had went out. You know, I guess he had an argument with his girl that night, so my buddy went around there and picked him up, and they, you know, went out on the beach. They met up with some girls over there. They was kicking it, and they fell asleep in the car on the beach. You know, the car was parked. So a policeman came up on the car, and, you know, like 6:30 in the morning, you know, you're sleeping, you're waking up out of a dead sleep, and they're telling you to get off of the beach. You got to drive back over to the other side and go home. So I think, you know, the Air Force dude, our buddy, fell asleep at the wheel, and it was a real bad car accident. You know, that my buddy had a Camaro Z28. You know how small the windows is in the back of a Z28. and how compact the back seat is. Chris was sitting in the back seat. He went out the back window of the Z28 and it almost ripped his whole shoulder out. I didn't, you know, it's quite obvious I didn't see the scene, but that's what happened. I mean, to this day, nobody knows how the car actually, how the situation actually happened to how he flew out of there, but he was in the back seat. But he was out of the car.
Because ever since then, like, we just seen him always with, like, this cast on his arm, but
right,
we never knew what happened.
He was really supposed to have had it all amputated, but he didn't want to.
Got you.
So because all of that was dead. All of the whole arm was dead, but he didn't want to amputate it, so he kept it in a sling, the way I guess he would look normal.
So before we close out, what are you doing in 2018?
Well, still doing tracks.
Okay.
You know, always looking, you know, to do DJ gigs and this and that. You know, it's the biggest thing is, you know, people know of you, but they don't really know how to look for you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. How do you? I mean, I got a hold of you due to my partner Steel at the Digital Sandbox Network that you go back with. Because other than that, I probably would have never found you a day in my life. So how does the average Joe that's going to hear this, how, if they want to book Mr. Mix for a party or whatever, just any business, how do they get a hold of you?
Yeah, they can get through me, to me on my Instagram. It's Mr. Mix, MRMIXX, the number 4, real. That's the best way to reach me on Instagram. I don't do Twitter. I got personal Facebook, but, you know, Instagram is the way that I could be reached. And basically all my info to be able to holler at me, you know, I always check my messages on there, even though, you know, that's, you know, you could, you know, direct, you could DM me, you know what I mean? Leave whatever info you want to leave, you know, and I holler back, you know what I mean? That's my main way to be contacted now.
When you heard stuff like, My Boo, when you heard, like, Shorty Swing My Way, Ghost Town DJs and all that stuff, did you say, hold up, that's my sound? Did you ever say that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was a gang of copycats. It's just that a lot of them didn't get to be heard nationally. If you was in Miami, you would hear a gang of records that were similar to that. You know what I mean? But they didn't have major distribution. You know, My Boo.
What did you think about crunk music?
Crunk, well, crunk is a hybrid of what it is that I was doing. Lil Jon them just slowed the beats down and, you know, and he took, you know, the fact of how Luke would do the, you know, the chant vocals, you know, it's a hybrid of what it is that we had. And
like a call and response type thing, right?
Right, exactly.
Got you. Yeah. All right, so before I go, I just need one crazy ass tour story. What is the craziest shit you've seen on the road?
I don't know if I can narrow it down, but I could give you a couple of scenarios. There was one show that we had in Louisville, Kentucky. It was Latifah, a bunch of people was on this particular show. So we're doing our regular stuff, you know, they'll always would bring girls from out of the audience to come and dance. And, you know, sometimes Marquise would pick the girls up and slam them down like he's humping them and this and that. And, there was this one girl that, they pulled up on the stage. She felt like she was missed all of that. You know, she, was on the stage dancing. Luke would get up behind her and she tried to elbow Luke when he got behind her, right? So he played it off. He did it again. And she, like, we tried to swing on him. So I said, wait a minute. You must got it mixed up. We brought you up here so you think you something. So when the girl had walked away from Luke and was getting ready to walk off the stage, Luke trotted up behind her and kicked her square in the ass. He must have went up about 5 feet in the air. In the hole. You could imagine. I mean, it's something that you would like, you would see on Instagram now. Something wild and crazy.
Itself, he'd be a meme.
Exactly. Wow. So, you know, all kind of crazy stuff like that. what happened. Our shows, it was never two shows alike. It would always, you know, and the crowd would always be the reason why it wasn't alike. Always.
Did y'all get the drawers thrown on the stage, the girls getting completely naked in the crowd?
In some of the smaller clubs, not the arena places, that wouldn't happen.
Got you.
But like the smaller nightclub action, the more intimate clubs, those type of things would happen.
How did the other countries take to the music?
Huh?
How did the other countries take to the music? Did y'all travel out of the country a lot?
Well, we never did. Well, we did do some shows in Japan as a unit. But we never went to Europe. We were supposed to go to, this is another unbelievable story.
Hold up, y'all never been to Europe as Two Live Crew?
No, not what all
Holy
four of us.
Holy shit. Holy shit.
There was a big thing that was going on in Amsterdam that we were supposed to go to. And, we're all at the airport getting ready to fly over there. Turns out that, who did the travel agency that did the plane tickets didn't mm-hmm. realize that Kid Ice is his situation is from Trinidad. So from being a Trinidad citizen, even though he's in the United States and a U.S. citizen, he needed a special visa in order to go. And we found out right when we was getting ready to get on the plane. So
wow.
Instead of getting on the plane, we ended up not going.
Wow. Imagine the money.
So you would think that we were friends. Yeah, you would think that we were friends, huh?
Wow. Yeah, you didn't even know shit like that. Yeah. Interesting. So, Mr. Mix, man, I thank you for, you know, spending this hour and some change with me, you know, giving me some information. We're going to have to do a part two because there's a little bit more that I know we could go into, you know, some of the other crazy stuff that, and I really want to educate the younger audience, the people that's coming up, and even the people in Miami, they need to know who the hell you are because you definitely, you was an import to Miami, but you're definitely a part of putting that town
right
on the map,
yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one thing that, you know, that I'm, you know, kind of upset at myself, you know, that I didn't make myself out to be an individual. I was really a team player, wasn't necessarily mm-hmm. trying to be out in the front. And really, at you know, my earlier years, I really didn't know how to be out in front. So mm-hmm. you know, you don't really think about you know the significance of those things when you're doing them, and you know, but you're still in a successful atmosphere. People are respecting you. You know, you're making good money, this that, and the other, but you're not thinking about what the outside world knows. You know, the people that's up close and around. They giving you all your props and this and that. They know all what it is that's going on, but the people on the outside don't know. So, you know, I learned that, like I said, when I left the group, you know, everybody thought that I was either taking direction from Luke. Nah, you couldn't have been the one that was doing all that. Not you. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I didn't believe it. Well, when Steele told me, this is the founder of Two Live Crew, I was like, no, he ain't. Luke is the founder. Luke is the leader. And he's like, nah, he's the one who put all the shit together. I'm like, nah, I'm saying to myself, man, Steele full of shit. There's no way in hell that Mr. Mix is the guy. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, yo, that was Luke. You know, and you know, that's why I speak to the unsung heroes in hip-hop because, you know, many of you did a lot for the culture. And people just don't know it. You know, and we have to get these stories out there and we have to let people know that it is people who really, really put their life, you know, their youth was taken, everything was taken in this business, you know,
right.
for this thing that you call hip hop. And you're not even mad and bitter. You've been laughing on the phone and shit. You know what I'm saying? You're sitting in a comfortable, good space. So that's definitely happy to hear that even when you think of the missed money, the missed opportunities, the bad friendships, but you're still in good spirits, and I'm happy for you for that. You know what I'm saying? If nothing.
Yeah, else, well, the thing is, you know, and my philosophy why I feel like that is because I feel like I live in the Brady effect. A lot of times, you know, you never know what's at the end of it for you. As long as you stay healthy, keep your game up, keep your skills up, you never know what's going to come down the pipeline. Just like I didn't know what was going to happen when I initially came to Miami. I knew
Got
one
you.
Thing, that if it didn't work out, I just got out of the service, and you get a 2-year buffer to change your mind to go back in if you want to. So if it didn't work out, I would have just went back into the service. So
got you.
You know, so it was just situation just worked the way that it worked. You know, there are days that are, you know, more trying than others. You know, you have to constantly tell the story, but it's cool mm-hmm. because it just lets you know that what you did was extremely significant. The information.
No, you definitely appreciate it. I appreciate you because, like I said, I was like, man, this shit is corny. But then I was like, hold up, man, look at all them chicks. This shit can't be corny if the girls like it. And then, you know, I was a little kid, so it's like almost finding an ass book, you know, your pop's ass book
right.
under the bed or something like that. You know, you find a Playboy magazine under the show. This is Playboy on TV. So I'm like, holy shit,
right.
you're supposed to be looking at this shit. So thank y'all, you know what I'm saying? So, and then when I look back, you know, I just remember, and then I was like, you know, when Steel was like, Mr. Mitt, I was like, hold up, him? Holy shit. Like, he is one of the dudes, but I'm glad that, you know, one day, you know, hopefully through this platform and various other platforms, the world will know your greatness and what you contributed to the game. And I'm definitely going to make sure that I let the world
yeah.
know that you definitely added on to this culture. You're not just somebody who came and, you know, robbed and exploited the culture. And you, like I said, you've been laughing on the phone and we having a good time just kicking it like we speak every day. You know what I'm saying? And
right, exactly.
And you're not bitter and angry. And like I said, I know some days you wake up and say, damn, man, but you know, you stay ready. You know what I'm saying? So you don't have to get ready. So when that phone ring and if something else pop up, you're ready to go. You know what I'm saying? And that's the best attitude to have. So, bro, yo, I thank you for your time. I'll talk to you later on.
No problem. I appreciate the opportunity for it to be spoken on, for sure.
No problem. Thank you. Peace.
All right. Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
All right, all right. I got to get the fuck out of here. Thank you for listening to Doggy Diamonds No Filter Podcast. If you like this podcast, make sure you share this. Spread the word. Talk about it. Argue with me. I don't give a fuck what you do. Leave a comment. This is Doggy Diamonds. I'm out of here. See you on the next podcast. Peace. Doggy Diamonds did this. Did this.